Hiya, my name is Lauren A. Fields, and this is Your Next Podcast, the podcast which creates a brilliant list of shows for you to try, adding a new one each and every week. The show this week is one that's going to immediately make you check your annual leave allowance and start scrolling through Airbnb. It's a brand new show called Travel Secrets, hosted by travel impresario Tanya Rose. She talks to all kinds of well-traveled people who share anecdotes, recommendations, and secrets about the places they've been to. The lineup for Series 1 looks really ace, with Trini Woodall, Anya Hundmarch, and Ruthie Rogers in the mix. And Episode 1 is with actor Mark Strong. So consider this a little holiday treat from me to you. Enjoy.
You're listening to Travel Secrets with Tanya Rose, the podcast that shares wisdom for fellow travelers.
Welcome to Travel Secrets with me, Tanya Rose, the podcast sharing wisdom for fellow travelers. Each week, I ask my guests to reveal their 6 travel secrets and the trips and holidays that uncover them. My guest today is the Olivier-winning actor and wonderful Mark Strong. Mark first appeared on our screens in the late 90s in the incredible BBC drama Our Friends in the North, and has appeared in countless fabulous films such as the Kingsman trilogy, Stardust, which, as I told you, is one of my favourite, Sherlock Holmes in 1917. He won an Olivier Award for his acclaimed performance in Arthur Miller's A View from a Bridge, which he also performed on Broadway. And coming up in September, October, we're going to be able to see him in Oedipus in the West End.
That's right.
As well as travelling far and wide for his work, Mark has spent time in Germany due to his family connections. So I'm thrilled and excited not only to meet one of my favourite British actors, but also to hear some of your travel secrets.
Well, I'm blushing.
I'm so pleased to meet you, Mark. Growing up with an Austrian mother, Italian father, has travel impacted who you have become? Just tell us, before we go into the travel secrets, a bit more about you and how travel has made you become the man you are.
I'd never really thought about that, but having parents who are not English, even though I was born here in London, and speaking German already gives you a sort of take on somewhere else, another part of the world. And I did grow up as a kid with my grandma in Austria, because my mum was a working single mum. My dad, he wasn't around. And in order to earn the money to support us both, she'd often ship me back over to Austria to go and stay with my gran. So I grew up kind of both in Austria and London. So I already had a sense of travel. And when my mum moved away from England when I was 11, I used to travel on my own.
I was an
accompanied minor.
Oh, yes, with one of those things around your neck on the aeroplane.
Well, there'd always be a stewardess or somebody assigned to you who'd basically get you to the plane, put you on the plane and pick you up at the other end. So I was used to travelling from a very young age on my own.
Where in Austria?
Vienna is where my grandmother's from and where my mother grew up, but she then moved to a place called Schladming in the Steiermark, Styria, we call it. And it in the 80s, it became a very successful, popular ski resort. And I think it still is now.
Do you go back there?
No, I would like to, though, because I'd like to see how it changed. Because when I was there as a kid, we used to do things like get a tractor tire, chuck it in the Enns River. And it's called ENNS, I think, the river, if I remember correctly. And then just float down the river on these tractor tires. And
how wonderful.
Yeah, you know, hang out in fields, and it was very rural. I have very fond memories of it, but I think it's changed enormously now to accommodate the whole skiing aspect.
Do you ski?
I do, yeah. I mean, largely because when I was a kid, there was a ski lift at the top of my gran's road. It wasn't exotic or special. It was just something to do. I used to take my skis, walk up the road. There was an incredibly rickety ski lift that used to take you up there in the winter. And I learned to ski from the age of 5.
And have you taken your boys skiing?
Yeah, we've been skiing. They love it.
Do they? Are they better than you now?
Well, they are. They're snowboarders.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. Mm. I tried it once, got covered in bruises and decided it wasn't for me.
No, not for me. I grew up skiing too. I tried it once and broke my collarbone. So that was it.
Oh, no.
Never again.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Actually, my son, just on this last trip we had to Switzerland, he, on the last run, did exactly that. We got a call that he'd broken his collarbone, and they were very efficient at getting him down off the mountain into the clinic. And then I realized when we got to the clinic how many people get injured skiing, because every single cubicle was full.
Oh, poor thing. Oh, I hope he gets better soon. I actually now am reliving it. It was quite painful.
A long time ago, though.
Let's get into your travel secrets. So, travel secret number one, what is the number one destination that you believe everyone should go to once in their life?
Well, my favorite place on earth, I think I discovered relatively recently, is Japan. I feel like it's still somewhere that is culturally completely different. And the first time I went there actually was with the theater. I went to the National Theater. I was doing Richard III and King Lear, two plays, one cast doing both plays. Oh, Brian Cox was King Lear. Ian McKellen was Richard III.
Oh my goodness, how wonderful.
And there was a guy in Japan, in Tokyo, who had built some apartment block. And I think in order to justify him having the land and being able to do that, he had to build something to do with the arts. So he built a replica of Shakespeare's globe.
Oh, did he?
This was before we even had a globe in the UK, in London. And he would invite theatre companies from the UK to go and do Shakespeare. So we did Lear and Richard III there. But this was 1990. So it was pre-phones, pre-Google Maps. Very few people spoke English. I mean, even now, not an awful lot of Japanese people speak English when you go. And finding your way around was hilarious because you had absolutely no idea where you were going most of the time.
And all the signs are in Japanese.
Exactly. And there was nothing in English. I mean, you'd go into a restaurant and just point at something and hope for the best. I mean,
and some live thing would arrive. You'd be.
I mean, usually it was amazing. Yeah. So you'd be fine because it was just culturally so fascinating. And I just remember realizing I was somewhere very, very different. And I think everybody should experience that once in their lives.
Have you been back since?
Many times. We've been back skiing a couple of times because the skiing there is incredible. In the north, there is Hokkaido, I think is the, it's a much more Western five-star kind of experience. Lots of Australians there. So if you like that, there's that. But we wanted something a little bit different. We went to a place called Nozawa Onsen, which is a bit four-star and a bit analog.
Yeah.
You know, and plenty of places to go and have hot baths. And the skiing, it was amazing. The snow is incredible in Japan. There were very few Westerners in Nozawa Onsen. It may be different now. And it was really lovely. We also went to a place called Hapa'one, which is a whole valley that has many resorts along it. And again, the snow, incredible. But also, I've been all over. I've been to Nagasaki and Tokyo. And we even got a car last time we went, because with Google Maps now, you can kind of go off-piste, whereas in the past you always had to stay in a particular track and take a particular train and have an absolutely mapped out itinerary, whereas now you can travel a little bit.
And you drove yourself?
Very brave. But
excellent.
You know, the culture is such that everybody drives really safely. It's really
is it the same
easy.
Side of the road as here?
I think it is, actually. I think you're right.
Yes.
So very simple.
Kyoto? Did you go to Kyoto?
We went to Kyoto, had a fantastic time there. Tokyo, Nagasaki. We went all the way down to the west and saw that incredible island where when Japan was shut for that whole period that you couldn't get in a few hundred years, there's one little island and one little bridge where anything that was being delivered into the country was allowed to enter.
Really?
And it's
in
tiny.
Nagasaki, how interesting.
Yeah.
But I've never thought of Japan for skiing, so that will go onto my list of things to do.
It's amazing. Yeah. There's something about, I think, the air and the mountain or something that creates an incredible, a particular type of snow.
Wonderful. So let's go on to travel secret number two. What's the most unexpected experience you've ever had when traveling or place that you've been to?
Cuba. I think that I didn't really know what to expect from Cuba. I'd seen lots of photographs of old American cars, very colourful. And of course, the reality is very different because there's an embargo and they are struggling to survive. Mm. Their system is very different. They have university lecturers and doctors are paid something like $30 a month. There's ration books. They still have ration books where you're allowed 6 eggs, 3 bags of sugar, 6 pounds of flour. Everybody's entitled to that, though. I think in retrospect, the revolution was intended to be benign. And I think the idea that everybody's equal, for example, now you have a year's maternity leave on full pay, which is kind of very far-sighted. And I think it was intended for the people. But the problem is the economy suffered. And then with the embargo on top of that from the States, they can't really get going. There's no capitalist elements there, even now. Although the farmers, I think, are allowed to keep some of their crop back and sell it rather than just give it to the government. But going to government outlets for food was fascinating because there'd be lots of tables, but they all had exactly the same produce at exactly the same price.
Wow.
And I said to one of the ladies, a woman that I met, how do you choose who you go to? She said, well, just whoever's a friend of a friend or somebody you know. But the poverty is
real.
Grinding. Mm. But you get out into the country because it's a huge island and it's absolutely gorgeous.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Where did you stay when you went? Did you stay in hotels or did you stay in houses?
There are government-run hotels, which are kind of a little, they're a bit dull.
Mm.
And they cater for tourists and you're in a touristy area. We went to Old Havana and found an old house that had been renovated by a couple in a very sort of colonial style. It had an amazing rooftop, lots of plants, very airy, but in a very, very down-at-heel district. I mean, when somebody came one day to take us on a tour to go to Hemingway's house, they couldn't believe that we were living there.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, but it was totally safe, you know. And what I found amazing with the people there is their dignity, genuinely. I mean, because I've been to places where it's very poor and you find yourself finding it very hard to deal with the fact that the poverty is so intense. And often people will be on you in places like that, you know, like in, say, Morocco or Colombia, where I've been.
Or India or...
Yeah, and quite rightly, you know, if I had no money, I'd do the same thing. You're the guy with the money, they want to try and get some money from you. That doesn't happen in Cuba at all. There's, I think, an appreciation of the fact that you visited. And the fact that I think people have this entry-level food available from the ration books.
Interesting. I mean, obviously it will change because all of the chains of hotels and things are all looking at going in there. So I think it is try and go now, even though there is the poverty and everything, because I think it could become one of these places that's just taken over by chains and big high-rise buildings, which will change the whole dynamic of it, won't it?
It would be completely different then. And the minute it gets resorty and like that, it's gonna change. Whereas now they still have those, they do have those old American cars that somehow they managed to keep them running. And the feeling is very much one of they're very pleased that you've come to visit and very proud of what they've got to show you. Because I have to say what they lack in, you know, amenities and things, more than made up for by their art and culture.
And their culture's amazing, isn't
it? So every night we'd go out, you know, and see some incredible band somewhere. And everybody also said the food wouldn't be great. The food was fantastic if you find the right place.
But the music was cool, was it?
Music was amazing. One night we went out and there was this incredible trumpeter. I can't remember his name now, but he's like one of the top trumpeters in the world. They were doing this extraordinary music. Everybody was up and dancing. You know, the kind of energy was incredible. And then another night we were out at dinner at a restaurant. The owner came over and said, the Rolling Stones of Cuba are playing on the roof. And it was this 15-piece salsa band who were absolutely unbelievable.
Amazing.
And this kept happening every night. And you realize it's going on everywhere.
Yeah, wherever you go.
Yeah, it manifests itself. All that sort of deprivation manifests itself in another way. We met a graffiti artist, for example. My son is very into graffiti and art, and we met the guy who'd done a lot of the graffiti that we were seeing on the walls because we met somebody who was an artist and who knew him, and he came out, we went for dinner.
That's fantastic.
You know, it was a great vibe.
So travel secret number three, what is the most overrated travel experience you've ever had?
I travel a lot for work. So when I get to choose where I go on holiday, obviously you can choose places you're interested in. Often for work, you don't have a choice. Mm. And I remember doing a film, which didn't turn out very well. So I won't tell you who was in it because I don't want to, you know, give them a hard time. But I had to film in Czechoslovakia, and it was a place called Ostrava. Now, no disrespect to any Czech people or people who live or know Ostrava. It's near the Polish border. I had to look it up. And virtually the first thing it said when I looked up was, there is nothing really to see in Ostrava, but that
nothing
doesn't
to do.
Honestly, it just was like very apologetic. There's nothing really here. There's no sights. There's no tourism, but you could visit our mine. Mm. And that's what Ostrava was famous for. It had a steel works and a mine, and that was its claim to fame. I have to say that the place itself was quite pretty, but it was quite deprived. Again, maybe it wasn't long after the wall had come down, but I remember having to go and buy some elementaries, like I had to go and get some new pants and socks and t-shirts and things like that. I couldn't find any.
Oh, really?
In the shops, there was virtually nothing there. So that was a little bit of a disappointment. Having said that, though, most of the places I've been are great. That was an experience.
Did you manage to travel around Czechoslovakia when you were there? Did you go to Prague or any of the other places?
I've been to Prague in the past and I've worked there before, but not on that particular. But I had to stay there because the film was struggling so much. They couldn't let anybody leave. They didn't know what they were going to shoot the next day, what sets were ready or anything like that. So I was kind of stuck in a place where there was absolutely nothing to do.
But you're lucky that most places you go to are wonderful.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah.
And you've just come back from Hungary, did you say?
Yeah, Budapest was...
Was that lovely?
Gorgeous. You know, just one incredible city.
Yeah, it is a great
city. Very easy to walk around. People are really friendly, very, you know, very kind. Lots of good restaurants now. I think in the past they struggled with that, but now they have. And the river, the Danube, goes through the middle. You have Buda up on the hill and Pest down below. Yeah. So it's incredibly photogenic.
I think that Budapest actually is a great place to go to for a short weekend or a long weekend. Mm. Not on everyone's radar, not because it's, you know, difficult to get to, but I think it's a very pretty destination to go to. I like it very much. It's not my favourite city. My favourite city is Istanbul. Have you been there?
No, that's actually somewhere. No, where I really do want to go. And I've been conscious of the fact that that's one of the few places I have
been
able to
go to. It's absolutely fantastic. Just when you said about the Danube and everything, you know, you've got the West and the East and the Bosphorus. It is really superb. In fact, I've got a great hotel that I'm going to send you to. It's just opened.
I've always thought I have to go.
It's really fabulous. And there's some really great restaurants, great music.
Yeah.
Very good vibe. I think you'd really enjoy it. So that's the next place I'm going to send you.
Okay, exciting.
So travel secret number four, what is the best meal you've ever had, or the best cocktail, the best restaurant? I mean, food and drink is obviously so important to all of us. So.
Yeah, I think Copenhagen's where I've had the best meal. We went to a restaurant called Geranium, very famous, one of the world's best restaurants, multi-courses of very interesting sort of bits and pieces, tiny little wheat sheaves that was actually bread. And then one course, they invite you up to go into the kitchen while they prepare a course. So interesting. I mean, I'm not a great fan of, you know, tiny little bits and pieces. You know, sometimes it can, it's all style and no content. But the food was delicious. The ambiance was great. They have this word hygelig, you know, which is...
Oh, yes, the hug.
Yeah. I think outside the window, at some point, they lit a fire. So in the middle of the meal, you suddenly realize that there's warm flames coming at you from the other side of the window just to get the experience.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, phenomenal thing. The most unusual, though, meal experience I've had was in Tokyo again. My boys love sushi and we've been to many sushi restaurants. We got to know somebody who worked in one who had a connection with Japan. He was an Irish guy, so not Japanese. And he said, listen, when you go, I've got a very good friend. His parents run a tempura restaurant in Tokyo. You must go there. So we said, okay. So we made the arrangement to go. On the day, we couldn't find it.
Oh, no.
We went everywhere. We spent about an hour trying to find where this place was. It wasn't kind of where it said on the map. We were about to give up when I said to Liza, my wife, listen, I'll just pop into a bar. I'll just ask somebody if they know where this place is. And nobody really knew. One gentleman stood up and he went, I think I know where you mean. And we went out with him and he took time to walk us about 20 minutes to where this restaurant was. We walked all the way and we got into the restaurant. It was empty apart from one couple and the owner and his wife. And what we realized was we were an hour and a half late and we were literally on the verge of giving up. And what we realized was they had kept the restaurant just for us that night. And the couple they invited were the only people they knew who spoke English.
Oh, how sweet. That's
so
amazing.
That they could translate for us.
Wow.
And we felt so happy that we stuck with it. You know,
thank goodness
that
we'd you gone, found
I
it.
Know, because can you imagine if those guys, especially in Japan, where being polite and all of that is very,
very important.
If we'd just not turned up.
Yeah. And they'd kept the restaurant closed for
kept
you.
Kept it closed for us, invited their friends and all of that. So anyway, we got there and it was incredible. It was just tempura. And he had these two great big bowls of hot fat, I suppose, and live prawns, you know, which you can't get fresher than that. And yeah,
was it delicious?
It was absolutely incredible.
So your boys, even though they love sushi, they love now tempura as well.
Tempura they love as well, yeah.
I mean, did you tell them that it's not easy to find that so that they can look on their Google Maps and things so people can find them in the future?
I didn't want to embarrass them or anything. I just had to say, I'm so sorry that we're late. And it was literally because we found it very difficult. And they knew that was the truth because the gentleman who kind of escorted us there said, you know, they were beside themselves. They didn't know where they were going. And it is genuinely difficult to find. But then that's the thing I was telling you earlier. You know, the cultural differences are such that maybe a Japanese person would find it in a second.
Yeah, because they can read all of the little signs down the alleyways.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's go on to travel secret number five.
Mm-hmm.
What is your best insider travel secret? For example, when I go to Venice and I go to Harry's Bar, which is very well known, I always ask for the table in the corner because that's where Ernest Hemingway sat.
Oh, really?
And it has the best view. It's a tiny table. But that is the table to sit at, because then you see the whole of the restaurant. So little things like that, I think, are always really interesting for people to know.
I thought more about travel tips.
Oh, yes.
Slightly tips, boring brilliant. Travel tips.
No, great.
I'm very organized and very tidy. So obviously a huge part of travel is packing.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how hard and long you think about packing. I remember a friend of mine who I told, you know, I have to cut short. We were just having a drink together because I've got to go and pack. He said, yeah, but you've got hours. And I said, yeah, but, you know, I've got to work out what I'm going to take and, you know, have a look. And what I do is I get everything out that I think I might want to take. And the first thing I do is halve it. So I put everything out, and then half of the things I go, okay, and then the ones that are left, I try and fill it that as well. And just so I can take, I like traveling light. I have to say, I've just been in LA. I'd managed to travel with just a bag and some onboard luggage.
Did you hand luggage?
But when I came back, I had to buy another bag
because
I'd been given some presents and Excellent. Bought some stuff. So that didn't quite work out as I intended. But genuinely, I love to travel light. I don't know why. Maybe since I was traveling as a kid at 11, I've always tried to. Because I remember when I was at school, I'd have to think at the end of term, how much stuff am I going to take? Because you could only have a case of 20 kilos. So I'd have to leave my clothes, have to work out what to leave behind, what to wash so it was fresh when I got back at the beginning of next term.
My goodness, you were organized at 11.
Exactly. So had to be.
Wow.
Yeah. So now I'm very organized about packing. Rolling clothes, obviously, in a suitcase helps them survive. Adapters in shoes, put things in shoes, gives you a bit more space. But a four-gang plug adapter, I mean, perhaps you don't need it so much anymore because a lot of hotels now have their adapters and they have USB ports and stuff. But there was a time when I suddenly found myself taking so much electrical equipment with different plugs that I just took one adapter and plugged in my four gang so I
organized.
Could plug all of those in there. Yeah.
Otherwise you were going under tables and putting one in there and yes.
Yeah, or using four different adapters.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Yeah, that was a little thing.
I think being organized is actually brilliant.
Liza, my wife, travels in a very different way. She takes anything that she might need.
Yeah.
So, you know.
The opposite.
Yeah.
I think women, it's more difficult. Shoes, that's the tricky one.
That's true.
And then I actually hardly ever wear the shoes, so
yeah.
I am being a little bit better than I have been in the past on that.
I don't think I've ever travelled, and even though I pack very frugally and lightly, I don't think I've ever travelled and used everything in my case, ever.
No, I don't think
you know, you always take slightly too much, but then if you take too little, you run the risk of what just happened to me and you have to buy another bag to bring
another
everything
one.
Back.
Yes, exactly. So with travel and insider tips of places rather than packing, do you travel to one place more often on business? I mean, would it be New York or LA or...
I've been to LA a few times recently. Funny enough, not much films in LA or never used to. But recently I've been there a lot more. You're always looking for places to walk in LA and Abbot Kinney is one of them. So when I first went there, I stayed in a little hut just behind this guy's house, like two streets over from Abbot Kinney, and had a little place in the back. And the funny thing about it was I was watching a TV series about 2 or 3 years ago, and I thought, I know that little hut.
I've stayed there.
Basically, they used it as this thing in the series. I mean, and it was, just incredible. I wasn't expecting to see it in a TV series, but that's very LA. I've been going to LA a lot more. New York I had to go to recently because I've just done a thing with Colin Farrell called Penguin.
Oh.
He was in Batman and he played the character of Penguin. They're doing a series of it. So I went over. And I think what's happened recently with the actor strike, it meant everything had to go on hold. So everybody who was shooting anything went into the edit and suddenly realized, oh, we could do with another shot there. We could do with this. We could do with that. So I've literally just come back from doing a few days shooting in New York and a bit in LA. So very lucky to get to travel.
Lovely. So let's do travel secret number 6. What memory have you got from a holiday or a trip which is really poignant to you still now?
When I left university, I went with a group of friends to Sri Lanka and had the most amazing time. Part of it was getting to know a particular chap who had a hut on the beach. He was called Tilak. And he used to make this wonderful food and we would hang out at his place. And there were lots of places along the beach, but we really got on with him. He liked us, we liked him. And we just got to know him really well. When it came for time to leave, we realized he was running the energy for his hut off a car battery that he was having to constantly charge. That was the only way he'd get electricity to but for a few pounds he could connect to the local grid up on the road. So we gave him the money to be able to connect his heart to the electricity thing. And somebody went back about, I think, the following year to say that that was all up and running. He was really happy. And so we felt like we'd done a good deed. Then the tsunami happened.
Oh, gosh.
And basically he was right in the epicenter of it all.
That's
yeah.
Sad.
It was in a place called Unavatuna, right on the south coast. We had no idea what had happened, and were very worried for him because obviously it was cataclysmic. But a friend of ours who went over to help with the clear-up operation met somebody, not our friend, but met somebody who knew somebody called Tilak, who was around, who'd survived the... And it was our Tilak. And the reason that he knew he was connected to us was because when we were in his heart, we'd taken... There's a place called the Candy Hill Club in Sri Lanka, which is up on the hill, and you have to take a blazer and a tie. Now, only a bunch of idiots who just left university would think it'd be a great idea to take blazer and a tie to Sri Lanka. But we thought, you know, maybe we'll go and visit this hill club. It'll be interesting. Of course, we never went. But we did have, so on our leaving night from Tilak's place, we wore our blazers and ties.
Brilliant.
He prepared us a fish and we took all these photographs together. And this guy, Tilak, that they met, had the photograph of us. And our friend's friend knew that this was us. So we were able to find out through that photograph that Tilak had survived. And I think he's now back on the beach.
How amazing. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Really wonderful. And how lovely that you were able to fund him to have his electricity as well when you left.
We thought that was just a nice thing to do because we got on with him really well. But we were just then devastated at the idea that he might have perished in that.
Well, if he was right on the beach, he's very lucky he did survive.
Yeah.
So how wonderful. That's a great story. Thank you. So lastly, I asked you to bring a photograph and talk about a photograph that has a memory about travel or how you see travel. So perhaps you could just show us the photograph and talk about a trip or that photo. That would be amazing.
Yes, right. So I definitely have a photograph in here that will show you how amazing the place I've just been is, which is Jamaica. I was lucky enough to go to, it's a place called G-Jam. It's a recording studio. Very cool. So there were guys, literally rappers and reggae stars coming in to record while we were staying there. It's run by a couple of guys who used to be in the music business. They're sort of in their late 60s, 70s now. It's incredibly comfortable and very beautiful. And we stayed there for a few days. And then we did a sort of bone-shattering drive along the coast, which is wherever you travel in Jamaica. You've got a tough old car journey, but you've just got to go with that. And got to Goldeneye, which is where Ian Fleming lived and wrote all of the James Bond novels. And in fact, Noel Coward has a house very near there. And Goldeneye is an idyllic retreat. I mean, it's a very beautiful place and it's a real privilege to stay there. It feels a little like the Maldives in the sense that you can find your own space. It's a large enough area that you can get away from everybody if you want. There are various different beaches and there's a whole lagoon in the middle. So you can have beach huts on the beach. You can have huts on stilts in a sort of area there, or you can have a lagoon hut where you can literally just jump straight into the lagoon from your hut. They all have little kayaks and things and paddle boards. And in fact, one day we paddle boarded to the spa, had a massage, and then paddleboarded back, which is just...
So it's not just a house, Goldeneye. There are lots of different places you can stay, are they?
Goldeneye is the name of the resort.
Oh, it's the resort.
But it was his house. But now there are, I think, 20 different places you can stay in huts. But they're all spread out and there's plenty of room for everybody, so you don't feel like you're on top of each other.
And it was owned by Chris Blackwell, I think, who owned Island Records, who was the person who founded Bob Marley, and then he had other...
Yeah, still is. He was there.
Oh, was he there?
Yeah,
was he?
Yeah.
Didn't you used to have a band?
I was in a punk band, when I was 14 at school. Two bands I was in, two different ones. And that was really just because that was the time. It was the 70s. And I think I've said this before, but in Sounds magazine, there was a full-page ad that said, here's three chords, now go out and form a band. And in fact, that was done by an artist called Moon, I think his name is. And in fact, he realised that that was the thing that had prompted me to be in a band. He sent me a print of that very thing,
how
of
wonderful.
The three chords, yeah. But we took it literally. I said, okay, you get a guitar, you get a drum, you get a bass, and then we'll just make some noise. And that's basically what we did.
But you didn't go into the recording studio in Jamaica and do a bit of reggae or anything?
No, that
when
would
you
have been
there.
Great, but my sons had a fantastic time doing all of that and hanging out with the local reggae stars.
How
and
wonderful. So actually a great place to go if you've got teenage boys or girls, because there is that to do there.
Yeah, at G-Jam. Yeah. And the New Year's Eve party there, Grace Jones was there.
Oh, fabulous.
And there were 400 people on the beach and you were shoulder to shoulder. And it's like all those films you've ever seen of people having crazy parties. That's what New Year's Eve was like. I think Goldeneye was much calmer than that. So I feel like we had the best of both worlds.
Best of both worlds. How wonderful. Thank you so much for bringing that picture in. That's fantastic. Mark, it's been such a delight. I've absolutely loved talking to you, hearing all of your travel secrets, and it's been so interesting. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. There's nothing finer you can do than really talk about wonderful places you've been able to visit.
Aren't we lucky? Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Travel Secrets. I'm loving making this podcast and want it to reach as many people as possible to build this community of fellow travellers. So please do subscribe on your favourite podcast app and share with a friend. I'll be back next week. And remember, this podcast might not change your life, but it might just change your plans.
It does make you want to get away, doesn't it? I only went away a few weeks ago, but I'm itching to dust off the passport again. You can find Travel Secrets on Apple, Spotify, or Amazon. And once you've tapped follow for that, don't forget to tap follow for this show too, so you can find your next podcast. All my recommendations from the whole series will also be on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. That's www.podcastrex.com.